Turns out the question isn't to cut or not to cut interest rates, that is. The question is, why? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Thursday today, the 11th of July. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Here is the thing about the American economy. First of all, it's an unwieldy beast. $19 trillion in goods and services every single year. Second of all, it's doing all right. Right now, the job market, as we learned again last Friday with the June jobs report, is strong. Inflation, the latest report on which we got this morning, is right in line with where it's been, ticked up just a tad last month. But the word from the Federal Reserve in the person of one Jerome Powell, board chair, speaking before Congress yesterday and today, is that by all appearances, the Fed is going to cut interest rates when it meets in a couple of weeks, not typical in otherwise fine economic times. What we have here, as Marketplace's Kimberly Adams explains, is an expectations game.
There's not really a hard and fast set of rules that say when X happens, the Fed must cut rates. Given the current economic conditions, Menzi Chin, who teaches economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, says the Fed could kind of go either way.
Probably they are erring on the side of caution and letting the rates drop just because they don't see a big harm coming from it.
There are early signs of a slowdown, but things aren't particularly dire. Plus, the jobs numbers are still pretty solid, and inflation is under control.
If the market weren't expecting a cut, it's conceivable that they might err on the side of actually keeping the interest rates at the current levels.
But the markets are expecting it, and that can create kind of a chicken and egg scenario.
Obviously, market upsets may not be good for the economy. So it's not something that the Fed is going to seek to do, for sure, which is to upset expectations.
Sarah Bloom Raskin is a fellow at Duke Law School. She is also the former deputy secretary at the Treasury Department and served on the Fed board. Raskin's confident the Fed isn't being overly swayed by the markets.
The Fed is appropriately focused on what the economy may need now and what trajectory it's on in the future.
And that trajectory can look different depending on what data you're looking at. Ernie Tedeschi is a policy economist at Evercore ISI.
Before, there was like a balance of risks on both the upside and the downside. Now there seem to be more downside risks.
Tedeschi figures the Fed can go ahead with a rate cut, basically as an insurance policy, just in case things start to go south. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The robots may eventually be coming for all of our jobs, but Amazon's got a plan for its workforce. The company announced a $700 million investment in retraining today. It is going to upskill, their word, definitely not mine, about 100,000 people, a third of its workforce by the year 2025. But here's the catch. There's not much of a catch. The programs are almost completely free and no commitment at all to stay at Amazon when you're done. From our Workplace Culture Desk, Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino looks at what Amazon is getting for the money.
The retraining programs target employees at all levels of Amazon, so already tech-savvy workers can expand their skills in automation. And non-technical workers, like the ones in warehouses, can gain the skills to work with that new tech. Jed Kolko, chief economist with job search site Indeed, says the programs help Amazon walk a fine line, keeping morale high among current workers in a tight labor market, while simultaneously facilitating the technology to replace them in the future.
Working with models and robotics and other automated technologies will surely be in at least as much demand as today.
Brad Hirschbein, an economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, says training an existing employee for a future job can be more cost-effective than hiring a new one, but that's if the training is actually effective.
And there the evidence is somewhat mixed.
He says retraining programs work best when they teach a broad set of skills in depth that can be adapted to multiple types of jobs rather than narrow technical training because
trying to figure out which skills are going to be in demand in the future is very hard.
Amazon will also pay 95% 5% of tuition and fees for degrees in high-demand fields outside its current business model, like nursing and aircraft mechanics. Mike Olson, an analyst at Piper Jaffray, says the move makes sense as Amazon has already dipped its toe into new ventures in healthcare and drone technology.
To do that, the company will need a strong workforce that's well-versed in whatever the company plans to kind of spread its tentacles into in the future.
Imagine being examined by an Amazon-trained nurse and getting an Amazon prescription delivered by an Amazon drone. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Wall Street today, a couple of record highs. The Dow hit 27,000, and you know what that means, right? It means the Dow hit 27,000. That and $5 get you a skim latte extra foam. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A little bit of a slump in crude oil prices today after yesterday's spike with that possible hurricane brewing down in the Gulf of Mexico. OPEC, it seems, believes there is going to be a slump in demand for its signature product. We, though, are going to talk natural gas on this program today because the fracking boom has delivered, among other things, a whole lot of what's called shale gas in this country, useful in place of coal to generate electricity. But that does not mean the drilling companies are necessarily making money. Because as Marketplace's Scott Tong reports, natural gas companies are struggling.
You can have too much of a good thing in drilling and fracking. American companies have mastered the technology, but too many jumped in, says Tom Sanzillo of the Institute for Energy Economics and Financial Analysis.
Fracking has enabled businesses to produce more and more and more natural gas to the point where there is a saturation of the market, depressed prices.
You might think low prices would get drillers to take their feet off the gas, but no. Some had already locked in higher selling prices with buyers, and some executives get paid based on how much they drill, says Charles Schliebs at Stone Pier Capital Advisors.
Executives will manage their activities directly related to what their compensation incentives are. I don't care any other factors, they will always do that.
Over-drilling has brought overspending on labor, supplies, machines. 9 out of 10 shale companies in the U.S. spend more than they earn, according to Elisa Lukash of Rystad Energy. So, she says, they borrow.
I would say the whole industry is highly indebted because shale is a very young industry, really, and it requires a lot of capital in the initial stages, initial years of development.
There has been a cry for natural gas producers to sober up and slow down from unhappy investors not making money. At KeyBank Capital Markets, analyst Leo Mariani says some are getting out.
Energy equity investments have been very weak. There's been a handful of companies where there's been some level of activism. We've seen more shareholders speak out.
He says natural gas companies are starting to get the message and trying to, as one analyst put it, choose value over volume. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Those really into the retail resale business have probably heard of Poshmark. For the rest of us, Poshmark is an app. You buy items from other users, clothes, handbags, shoes, or you sell stuff you don't want anymore. Think eBay, but more social. It started in 2011, now has 50 million users. Manish Chandra is the co-founder and CEO. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Why or how did you decide that social was the way to go with this company?
So I had started a company before called Caboodle, which was really all about a social community centered around fashion. You couldn't buy and sell, but you could share, sort of like modern-day Pinterest.
Okay.
And what I discovered through that was that social was really the foundation for how fashion should be bought and sold. Of course, that product didn't have it. So when we started the next journey, we wanted to create a social platform, but we also wanted to make it very easy to post things and create things. So when iPhone 4 came out in 2010, we finally found a platform that was sort of the trigger. And today, you know, of course, we do everything on our phones, but 7-8 years back, it seemed like a big leap of faith.
There's no small irony in me asking this question, wearing as I am a set of khakis, and I don't even know what shirt I have on today. Why and where did fashion come from for you? I mean, you're nattily dressed, but but where did that come from?
Well, I spent the first 15 years of my life in technology. Yeah. I built databases, database software, was part of a couple of public companies. And as we were remodeling our home in 2003-2004, I started to realize that the process of shopping for the products was really hard. And from there started my first company, Caboodle. And we quickly found that the product market fit was highest in fashion. Huh. That company was acquired by Hearst, spent a couple of years working with a lot of the Hearst magazines, Cosmopolitan, 17, Marie Claire. And so in those 5 years, I sort of had the proverbial 10,000 hours of fashion experience and sort of got really excited about fashion and community.
That community then. Talk to me about how... This is a straight-in-your-face question. How do you make money off your community?
We simply partner with them. So we take 20% of every transaction that happens on the platform, and they keep 80%. For smaller transactions, $15 and over, we have a fixed fee, $295. And that's it. That's all in. We don't have any marketing costs. There's no other sort of overhead. It includes credit card processing, et cetera. And the buyer pays for shipping. So it's a fairly simple model.
To be clear, these are, at least for the start of this company, these were used clothes, people emptying out their closets.
Yes. Even today, 70% of the clothing is used, 30% is new, and they're sold by our 5 million sellers who are really everyday people who decided to sort of engage in this process of buying and selling.
I read somewhere that you credit Marie Kondo and her, you know, declutter your life craze for helping you out a little bit.
People yeah, Marie Kondo was definitely a factor this year, but the business has been growing very nicely for 7 to 8 years. And today I feel like reselling, this sort of whole collaborative economy is really mainstream. You know, we take car sharing. We live in shared homes when we travel, and we buy and sell clothes. And really, it has a pretty major impact in both the world of retail and sort of social front.
You're of some scale now, right? You're a billion-dollar company now, right?
Yeah, we did announce last year that we have distributed over $1 billion to our seller stylists.
Right. So talk to me then about growth, because as you know, it can be treacherous, scaling too fast. Look at Etsy as the example that everybody cites for, look, we've got these people who are doing these things and we're just the platform. Etsy has run into some trouble.
Yeah, and in the very early days, so back in 12, 13, we scaled too fast. And in those times, we had to really cut back our growth. But then we created a solid foundation. We have, you know, invested in technology infrastructure, people infrastructure, shipping infrastructure, dispute management infrastructure. And so the business at this point is really powered by people and technology and continues to scale. We have expanded it to home decor. Mm-hmm. We expanded it beyond women's fashion a few years back to men's and kids. And we'll be broadening ourselves out to the international markets. We just took a small step in Canada and opened up our offices in Canada to serve that community.
So who's your competition then? I mean, I'm thinking here of The Real Real with Julia Wainwright, who just went public, right? We had her on the program. Do you look at them and say,
Sure. So I think a lot of reselling marketplaces, including RealReal, are definitely part of our competition. They focus primarily on a very specific segment, which is luxury. We cater very broadly. But then also sort of old marketplaces like Amazon and eBay are indirectly competing with us. As well as what you see is a lot of physical retail is now starting to either partner or get into the world of resale.
There's a pop culture element of fashion that you sort of have to be on top of. Are you?
You know, if you'd asked me that question 10 years back, I would have said probably no. Today, very much so. In fact, you know, sometimes I surprise even my grown-up kids in terms of how much I know about stuff. So it's pretty funny.
Manish Chandra at Poshmark, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
That community we talked about, by the way, users, it turns out, are really engaged with the Poshmark app up there at Snapchat and Facebook levels, to be honest. We've got more about that in the full interview on our Corner Office podcast. Coming up.
You might be entering the gates of hell if you take a particular metro line.
That heat wave in France really raised the temperature everywhere, I guess. But first, let's do the numbers. With all the speculation that the Fed might cut interest rates, it's not really a might. It's just how much. Dow Industrials above 27,000 for the first time, as I said. 227 points, 0.8%, 27,088 is the number. The NASDAQ down 6 points, just under 0.1%, 81.96. The S&P 500 up 0.6%, 29.99. Amazon, as we mentioned, is going to offer a third of its workers job training and a plan to be rolled out over the next couple of years. Investors, however, did a job on Amazon shares. They lost 0.8% today. Ford and Volkswagen say they plan to expand their alliance to collaborate on electric and self-driving vehicles. More details to come on that one. Ford revved up 0.7%. Volkswagen sputtered down 0.3% today. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You know, there are times on this program when we find it useful to pause. Take just a couple of minutes and do an explainer on something that's in the economic ether that maybe you hear but you don't quite get. So I'm going to play you some audio.
Here's a fact. This bill is going to reduce the size of our deficit.
This will pay for itself.
This is a revenue-neutral bill and probably a revenue producer.
Eventually, actually, it does pay for itself.
That was Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey, also the Secretary of the Treasury, Stephen Mnuchin, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, and Representative Tom Cole back in 2017 as the tax bill that became the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was making its way through Congress.
It's the largest tax cut in the history of our country.
Well, it wasn't measured as a percentage of the entire economy, but that's not important right now. What is important is that just the other day, Larry Kudlow, the president's chief economic advisor, said this on CNBC.
I would argue strongly that the corporate tax cut has already been paid for and that roughly two-thirds of the overall tax cut has been paid for.
Now, we know it takes time for changes in the tax code to work their way through the economy, but paid for?
So the thing about paid for is that you've taken a verb, pay, and you've gotten rid of all of the arguments.
She's a linguist, so bear with me here, Jessica Rett from UCLA.
So we're used to it in a sentence like, Kai paid Jessica $10 for the beer.
Kind of a lot for a beer, Professor Rett, but I'm with you so far.
So when you say, Kai paid Jessica $10 for the beer, you know exactly how much and who is doing the paying and who is receiving the paying.
That's the argument part.
But if I just say the beer was paid for, you just interpret the sentence as meaning, okay, well, the beer was the thing that was paid for, and I'm just going to have to assume that someone paid someone some amount.
So back to that thing that Larry Kudlow said.
I would argue strongly that the corporate tax cut has already been paid for and that roughly two-thirds of the overall tax cut has been paid for.
In this case, because there's so many arguments missing, you're not giving me any information about who's paying for what. We tend to interpret it as meaning something like it's self-funded.
So are these tax cuts being paid for like somebody's paying for a beer?
These tax cuts are not being, I'm afraid to use the words now after this linguist, but they're not being paid for.
Howard Gleckman is a senior fellow at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center in Washington.
There's simply no evidence that the tax cut paid for itself or even paid for two-thirds of itself.
All right, noted, but hang on.
The broader question is, who pays for tax cuts?
The Tax Policy Center figures 65% of Americans got a tax cut in 2018.
So like any tax bills, there were provisions that lowered taxes and there were provisions that raised taxes. Look, the net effect of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, what you find is that it reduced taxes by about $1.5 trillion. That's what you have to pay for.
$1.5 trillion. That's what someone has to pay the government for the tax cut.
The only way you're going to, if you will, pay for this bill is either through economic growth that the bill is going to produce, which hasn't happened, or through borrowing. And if you borrow the money, you eventually have to pay it back. And the people who are going to pay it back are going to be future generations who are going to pay higher taxes or receive fewer government benefits. That's all there is.
Listen, there is still a lot we don't know about the long-term impact of this tax law, but there is some historical context that's helpful here.
You know, we've been to this movie before.
Ronald Reagan cut taxes in 1981. George W. Bush cut taxes in 2001.
And every time, the proponents of those tax cuts argued that they would pay for themselves. And every time, the deficit went up after the tax cuts were enacted, and in fact went up a lot.
So the next time you hear something like this,
this will pay for itself.
The corporate tax cut has already been paid for.
Eventually, actually, it does pay for itself.
Come on back to Marketplace.org. Play this explainer again. It's been 100 years since Europe had a June as hot as this June was. Temperatures topped 100 degrees all over the continent. A town in southern France hit 115, the highest ever in that country. Those temperatures are a huge health concern, of course. 13 fatalities were blamed on the heat, just a tiny fraction of the 70,000 people who died in Europe's 2003 heat wave, in part because government set up facilities to take care of people. But Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports now from the European desk. There are worries about what the heat did and what a hotter planet is going to do to Europe's economic infrastructure.
The French government installed temporary fountains and mist machines around Paris to help the baking citizens cool off. But the country will have to make far more radical changes than that if it's to cope with future heat waves, as France-based broadcaster Emma James told the BBC.
The public transport system here in France, it's very hit and miss in terms of whether or not it will actually be cool. You just don't know. You might be entering the gates of hell if you take a particular metro line, or you might be not too bad.
Air conditioning is not widely available in France, but James says the heat wave brought other problems for rail travellers across the country. Some rail tracks buckled in the heat. Trains were delayed. One key service arrived 11 hours late.
The infrastructure does struggle a lot when these kind of temperatures get this high.
It wasn't just rail travel that suffered, and it wasn't just France. The German authorities feared that the asphalt or bitumen in the road surfaces of certain highways was beginning to melt, and so they imposed emergency speed restrictions.
Extreme heat waves slow the economies down.
John Ferguson of the Economist Intelligence Unit.
It makes it harder to work, so it can slow down economic activity. So Europe is not immune from that sort of economic impact.
Ferguson's research suggests that extreme weather events, freak storms and flash flooding, as well as heat waves, now cost parts of Europe up to 2% of lost output a year, tens of billions of dollars. And it could get worse, says Timothy Hewson of the European Centre for Medium-Range Weather Forecasts.
It's widely accepted that heat waves are becoming more common and will become more common as a result of global warming.
Europe has gotten the message. Graham Edmond of the Institution of Civil Engineers in Scotland says European countries are beginning to protect their infrastructure from climate change. There are a lot of mitigating measures, especially when it comes to the rail network on which Europe depends heavily.
You can do things like introducing expansion joints to make sure, for example, railway lines are more capable of dealing with the high temperatures.
And he says there are also ways of preventing roads from melting.
It's actually making sure that the mix of stones and aggregates and bitumens is perhaps a bit more capable of dealing with the high temperatures.
Attention, canicule. Pour éviter le coup de chaleur.
Throughout the heat wave in France, the government broadcast this message at least six times a day, warning of the dangers of heat stroke. The health ministry set aside special cool rooms for the elderly in public buildings across the country. City officials handed out bottles of water in the street. It worked. In the 2003 heat wave, 15,000 people in France died. It's believed no more than a few dozen lives were lost in the country this time. But John Ferguson says the latest heat wave has exposed the whole continent's continuing vulnerability.
Countries in Europe and around the world cannot have infrastructure systems that either break or buckle or decline when an extreme weather event happens.
Protecting the infrastructure, he says, is a vital way of mitigating the economic impact of climate change. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, coming just as President Trump was meeting with his social media supporters at the White House, a big Twitter outage worldwide for about an hour. The official cause, said the company, an internal configuration change, said hardcore Twitter users everywhere. Wait, now what am I going to do with myself? That's what I said. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 227 points today, 0.8%. The NASDAQ down 6, just under 0.1% there. The S&P 500 up 0.6%. Amir Bibawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Aaron Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.